Greenland is not for sale, so President Trump called off his visit to Denmark at the last minute.
Had this had been Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush or Barack Obama canceling on the Queen of Denmark, this would have been a royal scandal of epic proportions.
But this is the Trump presidency. We hear from a former U.S. ambassador to Denmark. Plus, African Americans in Ghana learn about the legacy of slavery, and they run into some false assumptions.
You see, a lot of people, you know, they think you coming from America, you have money. No, it don't work that way.
And human-like robots carrying out all kinds of jobs.
But is the human element important enough, and will it weird out people?
But are the robots coming for your job? I'm Marco Werman. All those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is a bitter legacy that this country still struggles with. 400 years ago this week, the first enslaved Africans were brought to the American colonies. Today, when African Americans visit countries like Ghana to learn about the roots of slavery, they discover a complex relationship with the locals. We begin today with The World's Rupa Shenoy reporting from Ghana, starting at Elmina Castle on Ghana's coast. Elmina once was one of the busiest hubs in the transatlantic slave trade.
Oh, please, can you go inside?
A tour guide at Elmina Castle ushers us into one of the cells where prisoners were kept. There are about 30 of us, and we have to stand uncomfortably close. The ceiling is low. Suddenly, the room goes dark. The only light comes from around the edges of the door. The guide has unexpectedly shut it. The tourists, mostly Africans, look at each other nervously. Standing right in the middle of the room, Amson Hagen's eyes are huge. He's one of the few Americans here, a grad student at the University of North Carolina.
Thank you, sir.
It doesn't last a minute before the guide opens the door. He dramatically tells us,
"Condemned cell."
Condemned cell, he says. This is condemned where the captive Africans who wouldn't stop resisting were kept as punishment. We shuffle to the next stop in the hour-long tour of Elmina Castle. I fall into step with Amson Hagen.
Yeah, you looked a little freaked out by that.
Having to crouch down, you know, when I was small, I didn't have to crouch.
Amson's talking about when he came here as a kid with his dad, James Hagen. And his dad's here again, too. James Hagen is Ghanaian-American, a retired high school social studies teacher from Maryland who grew up here. He says the last time he was here, the guides left out a lot, so he's intent on making sure today's guides are better. The guide mentions something about pregnant women being among the prisoners here. James Hagen speaks up.
Question. You have something to say?
Amson is chuckling because apparently his dad does this a lot.
Being here for 2-3 months, how were the females, why and how were they able to be pregnant? And who made them pregnant?
Yes, who made them pregnant? How did they get pregnant? Definitely somebody might have slept with them.
The guide says the European slavers were the ones who slept with the captive African women. And he moves on. Amson breathes a sigh of relief. He says once, when a tour guide got to this subject, the guide pointed at him. Amson has lighter skin than his dad. He gets it from his mom, who's a lighter-skinned black American woman descended from people who were enslaved.
He singled me out. I don't remember who was in the group. I was young. But I remember him saying, you know, this is how you end up with individuals who look like you. I said, okay.
A little later, James Hagen presents the guide with another question.
Okay, were the slaves who were left here, were they in chains?
The guide says they were only put in chains when they were taken out of their cells, and then they were led through a door that he shows us. It has a plaque above it that says, "Door of No Return," and it's intentionally narrow, so captive Africans had to walk out one by one, from near darkness to sudden blinding sunlight. Amson examines the door and shudders.
Think about all the work and mental labor that went into constructing this place so that it was efficient for its task. It's remarkably awful.
The captive Africans who left here were chained for months in the packed bowels of ships until they arrived in the Americas and were enslaved. These days, that trip takes little more than a day by plane. Abdul Majid made the journey 4 years ago.
Everybody wished
to be born in America, in Canada, in Japan, in all those advanced countries. You understand? But you don't have a choice. That's where you are born, so that's who you are.
His journey to the U.S. started when he got a visa to see the World Cup in Brazil. Majid worked in that country, saved money, then paid smugglers for safe passage north. At the U.S. border, he asked for asylum. He spent 2 years in American detention centers before he was deported.
In the detention, I learned much about U.S. immigration and stuff. Even I learned so much about United States. So that made me feel like I was part of a country, you know. So when I was being deported, I was like, hell no, man.
The day he was deported, he says he was chained first for the bus ride to the airport. Then on the plane, he was chained to his seat the whole time.
Handcuff your hands, your waist, and your leg. I've never seen somebody would do that thing for me. Even a whole America, I've never thought they would do that. You can't move, you can't do anything.
The Ghanaian government has repeatedly, formally objected to the American use of chains on deportees during the flight home. And the U.S. government says Ghana is no longer accepting Ghanaian deportees from the United States. In response, the U.S. has cut back on the number of visas it offers to Ghana citizens. So Majid says even deportees have special status in Nima, the neighborhood where he grew up. It's one of the poorest areas of Accra, and it's like a maze of old makeshift homes. People nod to Majid as we pass.
You know what made people respect me more was when I travel outside. So when somebody hears that you've passed that journey to America, you come. Oh, even though you don't have anything, the person respects you a lot.
But since Majid returned here, he says he hasn't been able to find a job. We step over shallow canals that serve as sewers. Majid says the only toilets are some porta-potties.
People have to queue, almost like 50, 40 people to go in a queue to go and ease themselves. It's quite crazy, man. Nobody wants to leave over here. Nobody wants to leave over here.
Thank you so much.
That's my mom coming over there.
The home he, his sister, and his mother share is about the size of a big van.
The African-Americans who are born over there, some of them, when they see us, they feel like we are not connected to them. They call themselves, oh, African. Even aside, they don't do much. They only just come here to talk. Pa, 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 then go.
Majid doesn't think African-Americans realize how much help the people of Ghana need, or they don't care. If they did, he says, they'd do more than visit slave castles to understand their own history. They'd invest in the people here and help Ghana return to what it was before colonialism and the slave trade. But African-Americans, for their part, also feel misunderstood, in part because their American privilege came at a cost that some feel still isn't fully recognized. Also, at Elmina Castle, James Hagen and his son Ampson say Americans don't have as much money to spare as Ghanaians think.
Yeah, not all Americans have money. Get no bunch
never
of Americans
money.
Who are poor. You see, a lot of people, you know, they think coming from America, you have money. No, it don't work that way. Yeah.
To many Ghanaians, the American descendants of enslaved Africans are really lucky. But for people like Cynthia McCroy, Ghanaians have something that American slave owners deliberately tried to strip away from enslaved Africans, their culture. Cynthia's here with the group on a mission trip. She's from Omaha, Nebraska.
Just we saw yesterday where some gentlemen were arguing, and other people came and they helped them. They pulled them apart. They talked to them. It wasn't a negative thing. They just were there to help. You know, and back in our country, people just stand aside and watch or videotape it.
But Cynthia isn't kidding herself. She knows she lives in a much more prosperous and stable country, and she's grateful to be American.
We as Americans are so blessed. We have so much, and us visiting the villages and the towns see the conditions that are so different for the people that are here. And a lot of it is because of what happened in the past, what was taken from them.
Ghana lost many of its resources during colonialism and millions of its people during slavery. Those enslaved Africans who survived, Cynthia says, in a way, they fought for the life she has today as an American.
When I think of the conditions of the dungeons, the cells, to treat another human being that way. I can't imagine. Sorry.
For the World, Rupa Shenoy, Elmina, Ghana.
Tomorrow, Rupa concludes our series on the legacy of slavery with the story of one Ghanaian tribe's complicity in the international slave trade. Catch that tomorrow here on The World. Some in this country are wrestling with this history and the racism around it. You might have seen news from Portland, Oregon in recent days. There were neo-Nazis, anti-fascists, and riot police facing off in the streets.
USA! USA! USA!
That's from a report by my BBC colleague Ali McBull, a veteran foreign correspondent. He was just in Portland where far-right protesters and counter-demonstrators made for a volatile situation over the weekend.
They say they're going to keep coming back to Portland, which is making people in Portland really upset because a lot of people see this city as one that has really stood up to fascism in the past. And, you know, it's extraordinary. We went to an MLS game, a soccer game, the Portland Timbers. Their supporters club logo is an anti-fascist symbol. It was extraordinary walking into a stadium and everywhere you looked, in a packed stadium, having scarves that said against fascism, those that said refugees welcome, there were pride flags being flown all over the stadium. So, you know, it sees itself, or at least there is a very active anti-fascist sort of movement here in the city, which is partly why they feel white supremacists are coming here, because they're sort of spoiling for a fight.
So you actually also went to Florida to speak with a white supremacist leader, Michael Hill, from a group called League of the South, about the recent shooting in El Paso that targeted Latinos. Let's hear that.
I really am surprised it doesn't happen more often, because you look at these young white guys. They're being displaced. They're told that they're part of the patriarchy. They're told that they have this white privilege, and they're looking around and they're saying, "Where's my white privilege? I can't get a job." You know, and I know a lot of young
men. Why should there be white privilege though?
Because we created this country.
Wow. There's a lot to talk about there. What do you make of what Hill, the white supremacist leader there, told you about white privilege and creating the United States?
I've met over the last few years a lot of white supremacists. It's always very frustrating. Of course, we have to challenge these kinds of views, but they're exactly the same views that I've heard so many times. And you say, well, what do you want to happen to black people, Latino people who are in this country? And they talk about, you know, the League of the South wants African-Americans to be deported to West Africa.
I mean, Aleem, you're a non-white reporter. How did you feel when asking a white nationalist why white privilege should exist?
Sometimes I really do feel that I'm not white talking to one of these guys. There was one guy I met in Arkansas a very long time ago who was really one of the thought leaders from this kind of ideology, and he couldn't even look me in the face when we were talking. And I said, well, you're talking about brown people not having the same intellectual capacity and all this kind of thing. What do you think about me? And his answer was, well, I don't hate you, just like I don't hate my dog, but we're not the same.
Wow.
But in some cases, like with these guys of the League of the South, I wonder if they see me as different because I'm British as opposed to being someone of a Muslim background. And when I said I was a Muslim myself, they really didn't know what to do with that.
Aleem, I'm just curious about how white nationalism, neo-Nazism in the U.S. compares to other countries like in the U.K. and the rest of Europe, where there is a rise of far-right movements and white supremacy.
It is clear that the divisions that we are seeing here are also widening in right across Europe, in Germany, in the U.K. even. And there are similar worries from human rights groups about the mainstreaming of the language, the mainstreaming of the ideology. And so this isn't a battle, clearly, that America is fighting alone. These divisions are definitely growing in other places around the world.
Aleem McBull, the BBC's North America correspondent, thanks very much for your reporting on this and for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
Coming up, the diplomatic kerfuffle with Denmark over Greenland. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Let's turn our attention to Greenland, shall we?
It's been a crazy circus for the last couple of days.
That's Aaja Chemnitz Larsen. She's a member of Denmark's parliament representing Greenland. And, of course, she was referring to President Trump's express interest in buying the Danish territory of Greenland. Trump abruptly canceled his state visit to Denmark after the Danish Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, told reporters that the idea was absurd. Here's Trump speaking to reporters today.
The Prime Minister used a terrible word when describing something that we've been talking about for years with our country.
Trump suggested that the Danish Prime Minister was being disrespectful. For her part, Frederiksen said Trump's decision to cancel was regrettable.
I was looking forward to having a dialogue on the many shared interests Denmark has with the U.S.
Frederiksen says she doesn't believe Trump's decision to cancel his visit would throw U.S.-Danish relations into a crisis. But how much damage was done here? Rufus Gifford is a former U.S. ambassador to the Kingdom of Denmark. He was appointed by President Obama in 2013, and he's in Copenhagen right now on holiday. I asked Gifford how people are reacting to the whole story over there.
It's dramatic, I would say, in one sense, because we have to remember what we're talking about here. It wasn't just a visit. This was a state visit. So you imagine all the pomp and circumstance that goes into a state visit from an American president, especially when there hasn't been one in over 20 years. So it was a shock, I think, to some. And then there's kind of the opposite, which I actually think is more concerning, which is the kind of collective shrug and eye roll of sort of Trump just being Trump.
What do you see as a larger problem with that?
I like to believe that we can easily go back to a time in American history where people had great respect for us, where people had exceptionally high expectations for us. And that is what dictated American foreign policy, certainly since the end of World War II, up through the end of the Obama administration. And whether you were right or left or Republican or Democrat, you had a Western leaning face. You honored the alliances that had been loyal to us. You were loyal to those same alliances that were loyal to us. And the expectations on both sides were high. And it seems to me that the expectation of Donald Trump is so low, which means that the expectation of the United States is so low. And if this had been Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush or Barack Obama canceling on the Queen of Denmark, this would have been a royal scandal of epic proportions, I believe, in another administration. But because it is Donald Trump, in some ways they expect it. And isn't that a sad reality as an American?
What is the protocol for canceling a state visit? And as you said, Trump would have had an audience with Queen Margaret. I mean, is there a precedent for any of this?
No, that's what I mean. It's when you talk about either precedent or protocol, frankly, even separately with the Trump administration, it's very, very difficult to answer that question. But what's the precedent for the protocol is even more complex. I don't know how the royal family found out or the Danish government found out about the cancellation of this trip. I wouldn't be surprised that a number of the players at least found out the same way all of us did, which was via Twitter. Is it insulting? Of course it's insulting. Will this alliance survive? Of course it will.
I was going to ask, though. I mean, this has to have some kind of consequence for this alliance between Denmark and the U.S. because, I mean, there are centuries of positive diplomatic relations, but this seems to be a real serious fissure.
It is. But listen, I think that the Danes, Europeans more broadly, certainly NATO, the NATO allies are sophisticated enough and they've been through enough tumultuous chapters in their political history that they understand that we are in the midst of a tumultuous chapter in American political history. And they look forward to some normalcy on the part of Americans again. Of course, I'm generalizing, but the majority of Europeans look forward to some normalcy and they believe that it will happen again. So we're going to have some cleanup to do at the end of the Trump administration, whenever that is. And we're going to have to build some trust back. But ultimately, we're going to be able to do it.
Some, as you may know, in the U.S. are purporting that the request to buy Greenland is nothing more than a red herring, a way to distract from recent moves by Trump. What do you think?
You know, I can't answer that question. I just think if this is a distraction, any distraction that weakens the standing of the United States globally is a really bad move. And it again reconfirms the chaotic nature of this of Trump administration foreign policy, and that's a real shame.
Rufus Gifford, the former U.S. ambassador to Denmark, speaking with us from Copenhagen. Rufus, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Marco.
We stay in Denmark for some good news. The headline: people are actually pretty good to each other. At least they're better than we maybe previously thought. How do we know? Well, a new study conducted in Copenhagen explored what people do when they see a conflict between two strangers. Marie Rosenkrantz Lindegaard is the project's principal investigator. She told us how the study worked.
We analyzed CCTV footage, more than 1,000 recordings, and eventually we did an analysis of about 220 conflict interactions to see what bystanders were doing when they were witnessing someone in need of help.
So give us an example of the kind of situations where the CCTV cameras were looking at.
Not cars, not traffic incidents, but incidents where there was some level of aggression between the parties. So where people would get into a fight, would get aggressive with each other. So it varied from quite severe conflicts where people would really hit each other and become physically aggressive, but also just verbal arguments.
So what did you find when these conflicts occurred? Like, how would they get resolved?
Well, we found that in 9 out of the 10 conflicts that we were analyzing, a bystander would take an active role in trying to resolve the conflict. So typically a bystander would push themselves between the conflict parties. They would try to distract one of the parties, softly push one of them away. So try to avoid that it would escalate.
So you're in Denmark. Is the footage that you were watching, the CCTV footage, was it from Denmark, or can we assume that there will be different patterns in different countries?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is the study that was published in American Psychologist was based on footage from the UK, from the Netherlands, and from South Africa. Well, in those cities, we didn't see differences. So that was quite interesting for me as an anthropologist. I would have expected, cultural contextual differences. But what we found was a similar frequency of intervention. So that's, of course, puzzling. What is it in these types of high intensity situations that somehow trigger similar behavior, across contexts that are quite different?
Yeah, so did the results give you maybe a more encouraging, more optimistic take on the human species?
Personally, it did, yeah. I had not expected that people would be so willing to take an active role. I definitely not expected to find similar frequencies in these 3 different contexts. So, yeah, I'm definitely more positive.
Dr. Marie Rosenkrantz Lindegaard speaking with us from Copenhagen. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Big professional sporting events are becoming a thing in Saudi Arabia. Boxing, golf, Formula One, but critics say it's part of an effort to distract attention from the kingdom's human rights record.
What people are saying is that this is an attempt to deflect attention away from some of the failings of Saudi Arabia, of some of the crimes of Saudi Arabia.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. The United Nations is warning of a new humanitarian crisis in Syria. Russian-backed Syrian government forces are carrying out a major military offensive in Idlib province. That is the last rebel stronghold in the country. And there are something like 3 million people still living there with nowhere else to go.
People really are just fleeing and fleeing and fleeing. Where to go, they don't know. As if there is a hell behind them. They are really followed by death. This is what I see in their eyes. The fear of what's coming after.
Followed by death and the fear of what's coming after. That is the voice of Abdul Kafi Alamdo. He's an English teacher who lives in Idlib with his family. We'll hear more from him in a bit. First, Panos Moumsis is the United Nations humanitarian coordinator for the Syria crisis.
The situation is quite dramatic. On a daily basis, there is airstrikes, a ground offensive that is taking place in residential areas. Hundreds of people have been killed, thousands injured, and about 500,000 displacements that have taken place in the last 100 days or more. So life for the average person living in that area is really a nightmare because they never know when they would receive a strike. And of course, most people, what we have seen happening is they take their loved ones and try to run away to go to a safer location. protection of civilians is our major concern, to make sure that in the conduct of hostilities, women, children, families are taken into account and every effort is made to make sure that they are safe, rather than seeing them becoming victims, as we have seen so far.
I know the UN has supplied information about medical facilities to the government in Syria in the hopes of protecting civilians from attack. Has that helped at all?
Well, we provide coordinates of health facilities, of education facilities, of humanitarian workers' warehouses to make sure that they are protected, they are respected. Sadly, we have had multiple incidents on health facilities who have been receiving a direct strike, a direct hit. The Secretary General has now asked for a board of inquiry to find out really what has happened. And for us, this is very serious because a United Nations-funded hospital, school, water point, or operation must be respected. These are civilian facilities, and really every effort has to be made. And that's why we share also the coordinates and we alert everybody to make sure that they are protected and respected. It's the basic rule of war, according to the international humanitarian law and the Geneva Convention, to make sure that these facilities are respected and protected.
And are you concerned currently that what we just stated, that the coordinates are actually being used to target those facilities? Are you concerned that's happening?
There's no evidence to indicate that actually this is happening. I think there's been health facilities that have been both deconflicted and others that have not been deconflicted. There is markets, there is residential areas that have also received the target. So there's no proof to say that, you know, because of the sharing the coordinates, they received a direct attack on the ground. On the contrary, the opposite. We feel that by sharing the coordinates, we bring a tighter accountability, responsibility. Nobody can say we didn't know. And that's where we even further strengthening and enhancing the deconfliction mechanism to really make sure that the information is accurate. It's not, for example, we no longer provide one point for the hospital, but we provide four, taking the wall periphery. And of course, taking every measure to make sure that everybody knows about it and that as United Nations, we raise our voice again and again to make sure that these sites are respected and protected.
If Syria routs the rebels and extremists and conquers the whole of Idlib province, what will happen to the 3 million civilians? Like, where will they go?
Well, I mean, that's a big concern. Clearly, at the moment, there is a massive movement further north within the Idlib. The vast majority stayed within the non-government control area and moved towards the Turkish border. So this could be catastrophic because Turkey already is the largest refugee hosting country, but also there is a threat for destabilizing beyond Turkey, looking at Europe and looking at a massive movement on the ground. So that's where I think the cessation of hostilities, the peaceful solution, a negotiated way out is really crucial, and also finding solutions for where would these people go. Because at the moment, what we see is a massive displacement, which is continuing by the hour. And that really requires an urgent political action to make sure that civilians are protected.
So, Mr. Mumsis, what is the United Nations doing to prepare for that eventuality?
So we have a contingency plan. We have a humanitarian contingency plan to respond. At the moment, we have a plan that goes up to 900,000 people. Should we see more than that, there is no way the humanitarian actors or anybody would be able to plan for millions of people. We hope that we will not go to this catastrophic scenario because that would really be dramatic for the people. And I don't think anybody can be ready to deal with 3 million people. So the numbers are just huge and really enormous to be able to cope with.
Panos Mumsis is UN Humanitarian Coordinator for the Syria Crisis. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
As we just heard, people are still streaming into Idlib in the northwest of Syria. They're fleeing violence elsewhere in the country. Abdul Kafi Alamdo is someone in Idlib we've been checking in with regularly over the last few years. He's an English teacher who lived through the months-long siege of rebel-held eastern Aleppo with his wife and baby daughter. Like many, many others, the family fled Aleppo and made their way to Idlib. They've been living there since 2016. These days, Alamdo says he's seeing long lines of vehicles bringing more displaced people into his town.
When I look from my balcony, I see tracks, very, very long tracks. Even you can't see the end of those tracks.
Trucks and lorries
are coming. And of course, these waves are coming more and more every day. Tracks, cars, people standing on the streets don't know where to go. I feel hopeless that I can't help them because I know the suffering of displacement. I have already been displaced from Aleppo, so I know the pain that comes from displacement. These people feel really lost. They come from their houses, from their destroyed villages, to nowhere. The borders of Turkey are closed. And they ask for houses, no houses. They ask for tents, unfortunately, even no tents, no trees even. I mean, what else? What else? I mean, just keep running away, keep running away. We're so tired, really tired. I mean, psychologically tired, mentally tired.
When these people arrive from the south, what sort of condition are they in? Like, what do you see on their faces?
In fact, the disappointment and that feeling that they are as if they are living alone in Syria or in the world even, this is what you see in their eyes. You see that in the eyes of their children, pain. They are broken, in fact. They are broken from inside. They find themselves living in a condition which is worse than hell. I mean, to live or to flee in this way and to go to nowhere, in fact, this is the hell itself and what is worse than hell. You see, it's as if we are in a cage.
How are your two children and how are you keeping them hopeful about the future?
My kids?
Yes.
In fact, now I think of them every second. How can they stand with this situation? What should I do for them? How can I protect them? How can I give them a peaceful life? How can I make them be better in the future? Because I don't want them to hate life. I want them to love life. But to do that, they should see love. They should see good things in their childhood. So really, I'm thinking of that all the time, and I don't know how to do that.
Well, we wish those answers were much easier for you right now. Abdulkafi Alamdo, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Abdulkafi Alamdo is an English teacher who lives in Syria's Idlib province. Saudi Arabia has been talking about opening up its giant national oil company, Aramco, to investors. The initial public offering, if and when it happens, would be very, very big. Hundreds of billions of dollars big. But Saudi Arabia wants to do more than just pump oil. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has been investing heavily in something called Saudi Vision 2030, an ambitious program to develop new industries in the kingdom and to bring Western-style entertainment there. The plan is basically to modernize Saudi Arabia and prepare for the future. As the World's Stephen Snyder reports, that includes developing new venues and an audience for professional sports.
This is the sound of money.
WWE Super Showdown, live from Jeddah.
Saudi Arabian money that has been sponsoring some very high-profile sporting events in the past 10 months, like WWE wrestling.
The following contest is a tag team match. And Bueni
drops behind the Jebel. Also, Formula E, the all-electric car auto race. And football's Italian Super Cup, hosted in Jeddah. And coming in December, the Clash on the Dunes.
This is such a huge occasion for boxing, an iconic moment for boxing.
Sports agent Eddie Hearn announcing the rematch of the fight last June between a little-known Mexican-American heavyweight, Andy Ruiz Jr., who took down the reigning champion, Anthony Joshua, from the UK.
Stay loose, and here we go, round number one, heavyweight championship of the world.
When news of the location of the rematch went public last week, a spokesman for Amnesty UK said it was likely to be yet another opportunity for the Saudi authorities to try to sportswash their severely tarnished image. Sportswashing.
What people are saying is that this is an attempt to deflect attention away from some of the failings of Saudi Arabia, of some of the crimes of Saudi Arabia.
That's Simon Chadwick, who directs the Center for Sports Business at the University of Salford in Manchester in the UK. The Saudi monarchy has been widely condemned for the murder of Washington Post contributor Jamal Khashoggi on October 2nd last year. The CIA told lawmakers in November that it has medium to high confidence that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the killing. Chadwick says sporting events like the upcoming prize fight could build goodwill for the Saudi leadership.
Because it creates excitement and it's glamorous, and people will look at the fighting and look at the sport and look at the prize money, and we'll be thinking rather less about some of the issues that Saudi Arabia has had.
And the prize money?
It's estimated to be nine figures.
boxing journalist Minnie Larry is excited about the upcoming fight between the UK's Joshua and the boxer who surprised everyone last June, Andy Ruiz Jr.
As a Cali girl, I was overly excited for his victory because this makes him the first Mexican-American heavyweight boxer titleist. And, you know, it's just like the David and Goliath type story that we hear so much in boxing.
But Larry finds it sobering that the rematch is to be held in Saudi Arabia.
We can't just move on and just have a big fight there and forget that on October 2nd, someone's life was brutally taken for having an opinion and for speaking his truth.
Larry says that as much as she would enjoy the fight, she's not going to write about it. She's not even going to watch it, she says, because in addition to being a boxing fan, she's a journalist, like the late Jamal Khashoggi.
I would just hope that all of the journalists that are traveling to Saudi for this fight, all of the journalists covering this fight, remember those tenets that made us journalists. And keep in mind that you're doing this job that was taken from someone else and he was killed for it.
But Simon Chadwick, the sports business scholar, notes that Saudi Arabia is not the only country with a poor human rights record to host and promote big sporting events.
The Beijing Winter Olympics will take place during the first quarter of 2022. As we know, there are considerable issues in Hong Kong right now. We know that the Chinese army is massing on the border. There are issues around China's supposed treatment of its Muslim population in the west of China. You know, the question then becomes, why are we talking about Saudi Arabia and a boxing bout when you have one of the world's biggest sports mega events about to head to China? And really, nobody's talking too much about, you know, China losing their hosting rights to that event, for example.
Saudi Arabia's clash on the dunes is scheduled for December 7th. For The World, I'm Stephen Snyder.
We've got more on the story with photos of the fighters, plus a deep dive into the trend of international sports events hosted by authoritarian regimes. That's at theworld.org. Earlier this month, Simon Chang went missing. The 28-year-old Hong Kong resident is a trade and investment officer at the British Embassy in Hong Kong, and he is a new focal point of pro-democracy activists in the Chinese territory.
We pray for Simon!
Get him now!
Where is Simon, Mr. Johnson?
Go get him!
Protesters say it's time for British Prime Minister Boris Johnson to intervene. Chinese officials today confirmed that they detained Simon Chang almost 2 weeks ago at the border of Hong Kong. At the time, he was on a business trip for the British Embassy. Beijing says Chang was violating Chinese law. Gong Shuang is a spokesman at China's foreign ministry. Gong warned Britain against interfering in what he called an internal Chinese matter. The message from Beijing to Hong Kong protesters is loud and clear as well. For example, one of the leaders of the pro-democracy movement there is 26-year-old Nathan Law. He's currently studying at Yale University, where he's been receiving death threats.
I don't know where these messages are coming from, but for me, one thing that I am sure is I have to stay very cautious about my daily life and try to be smart and try not to get into dangerous situation. But I think all these cannot deter me from supporting Hong Kong democracy.
That's Hong Kong activist Nathan Law. We'll hear more from him tomorrow on the show. He's not the first to say so, but Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang is sounding the alarm. Robots are coming for your job.
Technology is now automating away millions of American jobs. It's why Donald Trump is our president today, that we automated away 4 million manufacturing jobs in Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin.
But some believe robots will actually help create the jobs of the future. The World's Jason Margolis takes a look.
In Japan, interacting with a robot has become routine.
They're everywhere you turn. In the subway, in stores, in the hotels.
Cass Dawson's company is partly responsible for this. He's with SoftBank Robotics, a Japanese-owned company that's designing robots in France and building them in China. We met at the company's San Francisco office. But I wasn't there to meet Dawson.
So we're going to introduce you to Pepper, our 4-foot-tall humanoid robot.
Which product are you interested in? Tap one of the icons on the screen or ask me about it.
Credit cards.
Whether you're looking for cash back promotions.
Pepper has 2 arms, eyes, ears, and a small smiling mouth. It can also tell corny jokes, or if you ask, It'll dance.
Yay! Let's dance.
What you're not seeing is a robot doing the robot dance. About 15,000 Peppers are deployed in Japanese and European banks, fast service restaurants, and healthcare settings. Pepper is now in U.S. bank branches, too. HSBC has them in Manhattan, L.A., Seattle, and Miami, and more are on the way. It's a way for customers in the bank to get basic information, like about mortgage rates or credit cards, without waiting in line for a teller. Dawson says something unexpected also happened with Pepper. A lot of people seem to prefer interacting with a robot.
Now, whether that's I'm going to feel judged because I don't want the platinum or black card or whatever.
With a robot, really it's a low-risk interaction. You can just walk away without appearing rude. So is Pepper going to take away jobs from people in the bank?
We've been dealing with that question for a long time. So what I say is we're not actually replacing jobs. As you saw with Pepper, we're replacing tasks. In the interaction with Pepper, it can't do everything that a human can do, and that's not the intent of it.
But studies have shown that advances in automation and robots have already cost millions of American jobs. And as artificial intelligence gets better and better, many are ringing the alarm bells. A former Google executive is warning that 50% of our jobs will be replaced within a decade. A recent Mother Jones article says that within 40 years, all of our jobs will be replaced. Truck drivers, surgeons, and CEOs, and yep, radio reporters too.
It's certainly reasonable to worry about that, but many of the people who talk about this today greatly exaggerate the likely consequences.
Thomas Malone directs MIT's Center for Collective Intelligence.
One of the main reasons I think that is that it's never happened in the past.
Malone says we've been through this fear of machines and automation many, many times before.
Think of the jobs of scribes in the Middle Ages. Their job was copying text all day long. So the printing press essentially eliminated those jobs.
And the publishing industry was born, creating new jobs, typesetters, novelists, bookstore owners, and newspaper delivery people. Still, what about all the scribes? Did they find new jobs? Malone does worry about people who are being replaced by automation today.
Can we do retraining? Can we kind of do better job matching?
Malone says that's a transition problem, though, that societies have long grappled with. And here in the U.S., job retraining programs are notorious for falling short. Lose your job to a robot? It can be tough to find a new one, especially one with comparable pay. Just down the hall at MIT's Sloan School of Management, I met with Eric Brynjolfsson. He sees great potential as robots develop emotional intelligence. Still, he's glad that people like Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang are discussing the social implications of automation.
The next 10 years could be the best 10 years we've ever seen or the worst decade. And that depends less on the technology and more on the choices we make.
Brynjolfsson asks, will the benefits of advanced robotics be shared by all of us or just result in a few more billionaires? But he isn't worried about a robot job apocalypse. He has a humanoid robot in the corner of his office. I ask, though, if a robot like that isn't coming to replace a person, why build it to resemble one?
We have a lot of our brains devoted to connecting with other humans, and we can piggyback on that when we communicate with machines by, for instance, recognizing their expressions.
And then there's a whole different school of thought. But is the human element important enough, and will it weird out people?
That's Ruth Thompson with Cambridge Consultants. Both Thompson and Brynjolfsson say it'll be tricky navigating future digital human interactions.
I'm a lot of fun when you get to know me. I can dance, tell jokes.
At SoftBank Robotics, they get that. Like Cass Dawson says there's a reason Pepper is 4 feet tall and has a childlike face and voice.
The intent is to make it, I don't want to say cute, but to make it approachable and not seem like it's scary.
And he sees Pepper as a way to put more people to work. Dawson points to rosier projections that for every job advanced robotics replace, nearly 2 new ones will be created.
We're talking about programming jobs, managing the robots, understanding how human-robot interaction is important. So all of the things that you see Pepper doing.
Okay, I'm not going to worry then. No robots taking my job.
For the world, I'm Jason Margolis.
Nice one, Mr. Robot. But if you see something that says displace on it, take it seriously. We leave you today with this track from the upcoming album, Displace, by Finnish-born jazz guitarist Olli Hirvonen. The title conjures up the sense that Hirvonen's music is challenging and, yeah, maybe somewhat unsettling. Hirvonen is on a campaign to bring jazz into new territory from his current home in New York City. If you like to explore, then the music on Displace is an open invitation. World's theme music was composed by Ned Porter. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.